This is a Crowd podcast. It's sunny in Los Angeles. It's a Saturday in August. Hey, it's always sunny in LA. That's the point. It's always sunny. Everyone smiles. Everyone's always having a great day. We're at a white-painted house in the leafy part of town, on its own little plot, a curvy swimming pool out front, citrus trees and shade. A red-tiled roof, made to look like we're in Spain, somewhere old and classy, not new and all make-believe. A hacienda-style home. That's how they've marketed it. There's people there. A housekeeper, a psychiatrist. We'll meet them later. They're important to this story. But they're there for someone else. Maybe the most famous woman in the world. A film star and a pin-up and an object of obsession. Whether you're in LA or New York or London or Rome. It's not true to say there's never been anyone like Marilyn Monroe. There's always been movie stars. There's been blonde ones. Ones with bodies that half the world wants to stare at and the other half want to ban. But no one's done it like her. And no one's paying quite such a price. She's not old, Marilyn. 36. She still looks like Marilyn, if there's a camera between you and her, if the light's in the right place, if the makeup is just so. The hair, bleached to platinum, curled round her face. The red lips. The face shaped only a little by the surgeon's knife. The figure, like an impossible mix of curves and tight lines, like a conjuring trick of reality and desire. She seems at home here. Bought the place 6 months ago, half cash, half mortgage. A fresh start in a town that loves a comeback story. But there's things going on you don't know about. Something behind the trees, beyond the pool, in those quiet, shaded rooms, behind the dark lashes and red lips. See, Marilyn's always given herself away. She's told the world about the foster parents, about the time in the orphanage, about growing up Norma Jean, the nude photo shoots, the acting lessons. The world's seen her in the big hits, films with other stars, but titles all about her. Gentlemen prefer blondes, some like it hot. She's always the ditzy dumb blonde. That's the part she plays, the part they want. Hair and teeth and heaving chest, innocence and temptation, there to corrupt, there to be corrupted. But she doesn't talk about the mother in a psychiatric ward. She doesn't talk about the sexual abuse as a child, the doubts and fears, the insecurities and paranoias. And now there are secrets on top of the secrets. The pills she's taking, the pills they're giving her. The men who are good to her and the men who turn bad. Agents and actors, heroes and presidents. The hangers-on, the ones who won't let go. The ones who depend on her, who live off her. And so it'll all come together on this sunny LA day in August 1962. The past and the present, the real and the make-believe. Where she has been, where she is now. There's one thing you want to ask in this house. This movie star, this woman who can sell any scene to anybody. Why isn't she making movies anymore? She hasn't completed a film in almost 2 years. The one she did nearly finished her. It's called The Misfits. Stars Clark Gable, her hero as a kid. The man she used to pretend was her dad. It's written by Arthur Miller. That's her third husband. Or at least it was her third husband. They're splitting up as they film it. And as they split up, she's falling apart. She's late on set. She forgets her lines. She slurs them when they're given to her. Her makeup? They put that on when she's asleep, when she's passed out. They stop filming for 2 weeks while she goes to hospital. The director says something to a friend, tells him she's doomed. I'm absolutely certain. Why? The pills, the booze. Sometimes one, sometimes the other, often both. Here's the thing about barbiturates. They slow down your nervous system, that's why they call them downers. They're supposed to relax you, take away the anxiety, the panics, help you sleep. Doctors think they're easy, cheap to buy, simple to prescribe, made in their millions, a magical buffer against everything you're scared of. But they're potent too, and they're never subtle. You try some, and you need more. You take more, and they do less. Stress? They don't take it away. They just postpone it. They feed it. So this is Marilyn, paranoid and stressed and unable to sleep, taking pills that make her paranoid and stressed and unable to sleep. She takes other pills, uppers to fight the downers, with alcohol to kick them on. And no one trusts her now. The directors, the actors, the money men. What use is an actress who isn't awake long enough to act? A star that never shines. She'd been first choice for the film version of Breakfast at Tiffany's. The studio goes for Audrey Hepburn instead. She starts another film for 20th Century Fox, gets ill and gets sacked. They make it public. It's her fault. They sue her for breach of contract. They want $750,000 in damages. So what does Marilyn do? She tries to fight back. She does interviews with the big magazines, Vogue, Cosmopolitan, Life. There's photo shoots on the beach in LA, the sun on her face, the wind in her hair, little bikinis and dresses that start low and get lower. And when they're done, she goes back to her house and waits. Waits for the calls, waits for the roles, takes her pills and drinks her drinks. Thinks about where she's been, where she is now. Here's the thing with Marilyn. She's always been trying to escape, to be someone who's not Norma Jean Baker. This kid with no dad and no money, always trying to please people, never sure how. And everyone she meets? They all have their idea of who she really is, who she should be for them, how they can really make her happy. She gets married first when she's 16. It's love as practicality, romance at gunpoint. Her foster family are moving away from LA, so it's either go into an orphanage or marry this kid from school. Of course, it doesn't work. A housewife at 16, a husband who's 21 and away half the time in the Merchant Navy. He doesn't like it when she starts modelling. He hates the idea of her acting. He wants this little brown-haired girl to be cooking his tea, washing his clothes, cleaning the house. So that's the first to fall away. The second marriage? That's to a superstar. An American hero. She's Marilyn now. Bleached blonde, long legs, a red-hot male fantasy. It's Joe DiMaggio, 18 years older, just retiring from baseball after winning 9 World Series with the New York Yankees. Likes to be known as the world's greatest living ball player. They're in love. That's what everyone says. But it's always men's own version of Marilyn they want to be in love with. Joe? He wants this woman all for himself. He wants her at home making spaghetti for him. He watches her filming that famous scene from The Seven-Year Itch when she stands over a subway grate and a white dress billows up and she's all high heels and legs and other men staring. And he loathes it. They're the biggest couple in America. Front pages, TV, magazines. But there's love and there's darkness. He controls her, hits her. 9 months after the wedding, they divorce. Which brings us to Arthur Miller, another older man, a playwright to follow the sports star. The papers find the idea of this intellectual and this sex symbol so strange that one headline just says, "Egghead weds hourglass." There's an ectopic pregnancy. There's a miscarriage. there's DiMaggio back on the scene, wanting a second chance. And all the time, there's the uppers and downers and the boos. It's the way it's always been. When she slept with movie agents, men three times her age just to get ahead. When she slept with movie stars like Brando and Sinatra. When she's gone to bed with JFK, another notch on the young president's bedpost. So she ends up in a mental hospital. The Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic, New York. In a ward for people with psychosis, locked away in a padded cell, it's only Joe DiMaggio who gets her out. Does this sound fair? Does this sound like what she wants, any of this? There's a line from Some Like It Hot, from her character Sugar Kane, a ditzy blonde, always playing it for laughs. She says, "The story of my life? I always get the fuzzy end of the lollipop." So we're in her house, on this August day in 1962, the sun shining, the films failing, the darkness coming in. The day before, she's been injected with a weird mix of stuff her doctors call a vitamin shot. Here's a list of these vitamins. Nembutal, Seconal, Phenobarbital, Chloral Hydrate. Right. Three different downers. Another to make you sleep. A Mickey Thin, they call it in Hollywood, to knock you out. There's a fresh prescription for 25 more Nembutal. This is what doctors do when you're that big. Give you what you want. She's been writing letters, telling people she can't sleep, that she's in chronic pain, that she'll never be happy. She sends one friend a lyric for a song she doesn't know how to write. It says, "Help, help. I feel life coming closer when all I want is to die." There's always Joe. He's been taking her out again, telling her he's sorry, wanting to get married again. But there's something she's told a reporter from one of those magazines, the one with the photos of her on the beach. She says, "You don't know what it's like to have all that I have and not be loved or know happiness." So we need to talk about the other two people in the house. The psychiatrist? That's Ralph Greenson. He's in his early 50s, his hair swept back and going grey, his moustache darker, wears a black suit and white tie. Marilyn's been seeing him every day for the past month. She's been seeing him for months. He cancels other clients for her. She stays on after sessions for a glass of champagne. She comes to his office, stays at his home. He treats her like a member of the family. None of this is normal. She's phoning him at all hours. He tells her how she should behave, where she should go. This is what psychiatrists do when you're that big. The other person, the housekeeper, her name's Eunice Murray. She's 60 years old, short dark hair, black rimmed glasses. It was Greenson's idea that Marilyn hire her. Now Murray's staying over in the guest bedroom, looking after her mail, answering her phone, deciding what she should do, where she should go. This is supposed to be Murray's last day. Marilyn wants to let her go. But she's there at 8 in the morning, before Marilyn is awake, gets her the glass of grapefruit juice she has for breakfast at 9. And Marilyn wakes up slowly, signs for a few deliveries, talks to a photographer, chats to a publicist, gets a massage. Greenson arrives just after midday, follows her into the main bedroom for their therapy session, sends everyone else away, except the housekeeper. At 3 p.m, Murray drives Marilyn to the beach. She wants fresh air. They bump into a few friends, movie people, Peter Lawford, the actor. And they notice. You can't not notice. How Marilyn's slurring her words, how she's struggling to stand up, staggering. Murray takes her home. 5 o'clock. Peter Lawford is worried. He calls her house, invites her to his for a party. loves a party, Lawford. He's connected. Married to JFK's little sister, part of the Rat Pack with Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. Marilyn says no. 7 o'clock. Ralph Greenson leaves. Says to Eunice Murray, the housekeeper, "You stay here. You watch her overnight." And the phone keeps ringing. Just after seven, it's Joe DiMaggio Jr., the son of the greatest living ball player from his first marriage. He's in the army, stationed nearby, always got on with Marilyn. They chat for a few minutes. He thinks she sounds okay. She's alert. She's happy. 8 p.m. Marilyn goes to bed. And Peter Lawford calls again. And this time, there's panic.
Hi, I'm Christina Yerling-Biro, host of the podcast Pop Culture Confidential. Join me as I go way behind the scenes with some of the most influential people in entertainment and media. Hear actors such as Succession's Brian Cox talk about his favorite characters to play.
There always has to be a mystery. The audience have to be in a situation where they want to know what's going on.
Meet studio execs like Pixar chief Pete Docter and learn his secret on how he makes us cry.
Emotion is our first language.
And so many others who are defining popular culture, from Obama speechwriter David Litt to Top Chef host Padma Lakshmi.
We don't often think about food politically, or we don't want to, but it really is.
Join me. Search for Pop Culture Confidential wherever you get your podcasts.
Marilyn sounds different now. She's not alert. She's not happy. Lawford knows about downers. They're part of his world. They're Hollywood. And he can hear them in her voice. He's angry and he's scared. Who's looking after her? Who's got her like this? He thinks she's drugged. He thinks this is bad. He tells her to come over, that it's okay, and all she can say back to him is this. Say goodbye to your wife. Say goodbye to the president. And say goodbye to yourself, because you're a nice guy. She stops speaking. Lawford tries to call again. No answer. He calls his own agent, says, "I've got to go over there." His agent says, "You're JFK's brother-in-law. You can't." So the agent tries. Calls Ralph Greenson, the psychiatrist. No answer. A call reaches Eunice Murray, the housekeeper. She says, "Don't worry, Marilyn is fine." And now the stories start to open up, to bend and to slip. Let's do the official version first. Eunice Murray says she wakes up at 3:30 in the morning. Why? Because she senses something is wrong. She says, "I saw a light under the door of Marilyn's bedroom." She says, "I tried to get in, but the door was locked." She says, "I looked through the window and saw Marilyn face down on the bed holding the phone." She calls Greenson. He's there in minutes. Breaks the window to get into the bedroom, tries to take Marilyn's pulse. Finds nothing. A doctor is called just before 4:30 in the morning. A call goes into the LA Police Department. We're at the residence of Marilyn Monroe. She's committed suicide. Okay, some facts. When the autopsy is done, it shows Marilyn died somewhere between 8:30 and 10:30 at night. They give her cause of death as acute barbiturate poisoning. They mention the empty medicine bottles next to her bed, and they rule out an accidental overdose. Doesn't matter, there's no suicide note. The doctors talk about abrupt and unpredictable mood changes. They say she's been prone to severe fears and frequent depressions. They state the official conclusion, probable suicide. That's what they say. And because this is the most famous woman in the world, the questions start straight away. This light under the bedroom door. How did Eunice Murray see that when the carpets were so new and so thick that it was hard to even close the door? The door being locked. There were no internal locks on the bedroom door, right? Questions and theories. Someone says, "It's an accidental overdose." It's the psychiatrist and the housekeeper. The psychiatrist didn't know how many downers she'd already taken that day. He prescribed a chloral hydrate enema to get her to sleep, and Mickey Finn, the housekeeper, administered it. When they found her dead, they staged it as suicide. Theories and conspiracies. Marilyn had slept with JFK but was having an affair with his brother, Robert Kennedy. She was going public with it. He had her killed to save his career. The next one. Marilyn was sleeping with Bobby Kennedy. The CIA murdered her as revenge on the Kennedys for the Bay of Pigs fiasco, for something else. Another. She's killed by union boss Jimmy Hoffa, by the mobster Sam Giancana. And all this stuff, all these wild ideas, all these make-believe stories, there's never any proof for them. Years later, the LA District Attorney does a review of the case. No evidence is ever found of murder. There's no evidence of an affair with Bobby Kennedy. There's no records of anyone else being at the house except Marilyn, the housekeeper, and the psychiatrist. So let's go back to what we know. Marilyn Monroe is buried on the 8th of August, 3 days after her body is found, in that bedroom, telephone in her hand. She's wearing a green dress, holding a bouquet of pink roses. The makeup man who always worked with her on film sets and photo shoots does her makeup one final time. It's Joe DiMaggio who arranges it all, who collects her body from the morgue, who invites only a few close friends and family, who keeps the actors and the agents and the politicians away. The hangers-on, the ones who won't let go, the ones who depend on her, who live off her. There's music. A recording of Judy Garland singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, selections from Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. There's connections to the past. The cemetery is the same one where two of her foster parents were buried. There's thousands of people in the streets outside, TV crews, front pages around the world, in LA and New York, in London, in Rome. And it's Joe with the role you can't forget. What does Joe do? He has red roses placed on her memorial 3 times a week, every week of the year, every year until his own death, 20 years later. Because inside the gates, it's all come together. The past and the present, the real and the make-believe. Where Marilyn has been, where she is now. And the sun shines, because the sun always shines in LA. This episode of Death of a Film Star was written by Tom Fordyce and performed by me, Emma Clark. It was edited by Charlie Frost. For research, we used the archives of the BBC, The Times, the LA Times and the New York Times. We read books including Donald Spoto's biography, Marilyn Monroe, and Anthony Summers' book, Goddess. And we watched films including The Seven-Year Itch, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, Some Like It Hot and The Misfits. The music we used is from our partners BMG Production Music. Enjoyed this show? Then you might love another of our podcasts, We Didn't Start the Fire. There's episodes about Marilyn, James Dean and more, because it's a cultural history of the post-war world, all based around the lyrics to Billy Joel's number one hit. Search for We Didn't Start the Fire in your podcast app. Thanks for listening. Crowd Network, a place where you belong.
Hey there.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Audrey. We are a sister filmmaking duo
and co-hosts of Sleepover Cinema.
Our show where we analyze the films that created the collective unconscious of the girls, gays, and theys of the late 90s and early 2000s.
Princess Diaries, The Cheetah Girls, Aquamarine, Cinderella, the one starring Brandy.
We haven't stopped thinking about these movies since we first saw them, and we want you to rewatch them
and review them with us.
Are these movies as bad as critics would have us believe?
Do we even care if they are?
We are always unpacking that very question on Sleepover Cinema.
Check out Sleepover Cinema wherever you get your podcasts or at evergreenpodcasts.com.
See you soon.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matt Neglia, and I am the host of the Next Best Picture podcast, part of the Film Entertainment Awards website, nextbestpicture.com. On our show, we explore all year long what is possibly going to win Best Picture at the Oscars. We do this by conducting interviews with people within the film industry, holding weekly reviews of the latest theatrical releases, and on our main show, where we dive into various different topics, answer your fan questions, and also do our best to explore Oscar history's past in hopes that it will tell us something new for this upcoming award season race. We hope that you will join us on all of the various podcasting networks. We look forward to seeing you over at nextbestpicture.com.